I'm Tess Viglund, standing on the flight deck of the USS Peleliu, an amphibious assault vessel based out of San Diego. 2,500 sailors and Marines call this ship home. The Peleliu returned from the Gulf just 3 months ago. We're here to talk about the unique personal finance challenges faced by members of the armed forces. Imagine dealing with your credit cards, your mortgage, your car payment from the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
There are personnel working aloft. Do not rotate or radiate ship's radars.
In this special hour, we'll explore financial counseling in the Navy, plus military spouses looking for jobs at home, parents caring and paying for injured veterans, and the hurdles faced by reservists who are trying to keep their businesses afloat while on active duty. And a former Army sergeant delivers donations and dreams to soldiers in Fort Hood, Texas. It's Debt of Service on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Almost 1.5 million Americans work in the military full-time. You might think that if you're serving your country, everything's covered: housing, food, transportation. But government doesn't and can't take care of every need. Troops have to do their part to stay on top of their finances. As the Armed Forces observe Military Saves Week, we present a special report. It's Debt of Service from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
Last year in the Navy, 84% of the security clearances that were either revoked or denied happened because sailors were having financial problems. More than 28,000 sailors got emergency loans from the Navy's Relief Society. The military increasingly considers financial fitness as important as all the physical training required to be a sailor, soldier, airman, or Marine. About 3 years ago, the Navy ramped up a financial counseling service. We visited the base in San Diego to see how it works. The amphibious assault ship USS Peleliu returned from the Persian Gulf 3 months ago. When we boarded, it was docked at the sprawling naval shipyard in San Diego. 2,500 sailors and Marines are stationed on the ship when it's fully manned, and Commanding Officer Marcus Hitchcock needs them 100% focused.
This is 40,000 tons of steel, but it's the people that make it come alive. So if the people aren't healthy mentally, physically, financially, then they're just not ready to take the ship out to sea and do the job that they need to do. So the financial health of our sailors is absolutely critical to the readiness of this ship and to the Navy.
Colonel Major Joe Poreth serves on the front line of that readiness effort. He's a Navy Command Financial Specialist, or CFS, an onboard money counselor. He's also responsible for making sure helicopters and fighter jets get safely on and off the ship's deck, where there is literally no room for error.
If I have an individual, he's out there launching multi-million dollar aircraft, and as he starts to direct that aircraft, he starts thinking about that money problem. That takes a toll on an individual. And then it takes a toll as far as my safety on the flight deck.
And the safety of every sailor and Marine on board this floating city. The Navy mandates one financial counselor for every 75 sailors. If only we had that in the civilian world. Petty Officer Robert McGuire, who's training to be a counselor, says it's easy for service members to get in trouble early on.
You get a lot of young people that have no education and training on finances, either in school or at home, and they have a steady paycheck. So by default, they come into the fallacy that they always have money there, and then they don't realize how much money they're spending.
Especially, says Poreth, while they're deployed.
The biggest thing that I see going on a cruise, you get to the Gulf, you get tax-free money. Then when we get into San Diego, those people are spending that same money that they were trying to spend out there.
Tomorrow, you guys know you got that drill tomorrow, right? Those 25 individuals.
Up on the ship's deck, a group of sailors gets orders for the next day's work. 22-year-old Petty Officer 3rd Class Chris Klein is among them, and he knows that spending pattern well. In 2007, he deployed on a months-long humanitarian mission.
Every time we'd stop at a port, drinks here, gifts here, just things I thought I needed, that really 30 days from then or even a week from then, it was like, okay, this isn't really that cool anymore, and you'd get rid of it.
Now I'll see you guys tomorrow morning, 07.
Klein is what Senior Chief Poreth calls a client. A few months ago, Klein asked for help putting together a budget for his family. Now he's putting money aside in the government's thrift savings plan, and he paid off all his credit cards.
You've got a lot of stuff in your folder. There's lots if you go online.
Off ship at the Fleet and Family Support Center in San Diego, 20-year Navy veteran Ed Olander is now teaching sailors how to be command financial specialists. He does some of the counseling himself and says no one is immune from money issues.
I've had everywhere from the youngest sailor new in the Navy to I've had master chiefs for 28 years. I've had commanders in my office in financial problems.
Olander oversees week-long training programs for new counselors. He brings in specialists from the mortgage industry, the credit card industry, and experts in how to talk to people about financial issues.
Get them to evaluate the seriousness of their situation.
As the seminar continued, Olander told us that part of the problem is a feeling of invincibility among service members.
Especially in the Navy, a lot of them are very technical jobs. And you think, if I'm operating the engine room of a nuclear submarine, I should be able to go buy a car. And I don't need to read the contract because, why, they're not going to rip me off.
But in fact, members of the military are frequently ripped off, from predatory lending to its evil twin, predatory retailing, where stores in military towns offer, quote, special military financing at 30% interest. Olander says just like civilians, some service members don't know better. Others just don't want to wait to get the things they want. Command Chaplain Robert Thomas was among the more than two dozen sailors learning how to become financial specialists. He helps mobilize troops going to and coming back from sea. He says some sailors assume every detail of their finances will be taken care of while they're deployed, and they show up on base without cash or even bank accounts. He says every one of them should go through what he called a financial stand down.
Every 6 months, we have to be physically ready to do so many push-ups, so many sit-ups, and run a mile and a half. And past that, we need to have the same kind of standards from a financial perspective.
The educators and sailors we talked to said service members don't necessarily have more financial problems than civilians, but the problems they do have are magnified by things like security clearances. And because they live and work as a team, one person's financial issues become a problem for everyone.
There are personnel working aloft. Do now rotate or radiate ship's radar.
Back on the USS Peleliu, Petty Officer Chris Klein shared his own success story. He says when he got back from deployment, he wanted a new truck. But because of the Navy's financial program, he knew better than to walk onto the lot unprepared.
And I used a lot of their tools, knowledge that they gave me to buy a vehicle. I had the check in my back pocket. I had the power over, you know, the salespeople at the, you know, the car dealerships. I ended up getting a steal.
With 6% financing from the Navy Credit Union.
Victor in war, guardian in peace. The Navy celebrates Navy Day 1 year after World War Number Two. Today, a fleet smaller in size but bigger in scope plans for the future, and that means manpower.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. By Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
Counselors in San Diego also tell sailors to be sure they shop on base. Discounts are available on everything from gas to haircuts. The Navy Exchange is a discount store. Roland Santos is the manager.
So here's the manufacturer's suggested retail price for this shirt, $138. Our price, $109.99. Average savings at the NEX are 20% versus private sector retail stores, and no tax included. Carry Victoria's Secret and Estee Lauder and Tommy Bahama right here. Right? There'll be certain items that the young sailors really key on when a ship comes in. Beef jerky, sleeping bags, because they take those on the ships and put them on their bunks. You know, there's just certain things that you know what the demographics are.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Counseling is a way to achieve financial security, but at one time, military service itself represented financial security. About half of the 16 million Americans who served in World War II parlayed their active duty into a middle-class life. But is that still true today? David Siegel teaches military sociology at the University of Maryland. Professor Siegel, first, how is the current economy affecting how people look at military service?
Since the advent of the all-volunteer force, economic distress in American society is good for military recruiting. When unemployment goes up, youth unemployment goes up particularly rapidly. Unemployment goes up particularly rapidly in minority youth communities, and that's good for recruiting. On the retention side, I've seen at least three surveys that ask people who are reenlisting why they are staying in. And one of the major reasons is job security.
We think of the post-World War II era as a time that the middle class really grew by leaps and bounds in America. What role did the military play in that?
The military actually played a role for people who did not have access to other means of moving into the middle class, particularly for African Americans, initially for men, but certainly since the advent of the all-volunteer force for African American women as well. It has provided a form of employment, job training, higher education, and for many of them, a career.
You mentioned higher education. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the GI Bill?
There have been lots of GI Bills or lots of forms of support for higher education linked to the military. The function of the GI Bill when it was first passed was, in an altruistic sense, to reward soldiers for their service, and in a labor force management sense, to prevent all of the demobilized GIs from flooding the labor market at the same time at a point where there weren't jobs available to them. When we instituted the volunteer force, people who remembered the GI Bill as being a tool of recruitment said, well, gee, we don't have to do that anymore. Walmart, McDonald's don't give educational benefits. The military doesn't have to either. It took some time for the military to realize that for the quality personnel they were trying to get, they were really competing with colleges and universities to get people who do make better soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines.
What about life after they leave the military? You know, recruiters commonly say that the skills that are learned in the military, that's just what employers are looking for in a potential candidate. Is that true? Do employers really look at this experience as something that they can use?
Officers tend to have a fairly easy task of finding subsequent employment, in part because most career officers somewhere in the course of their careers pick up a graduate degree at government expense, or they have had leadership experiences that civilian industry finds useful. Enlisted personnel, my sense is, don't do badly, but don't seem to get as much credit for the job skills that they have learned in the military.
So can we still call the military a gateway to the middle class? And if so, for whom?
To a large extent, it is a gateway to the middle class for those who stay in for a career, because they move up to positions where they have responsibility, they have authority, they have basically a middle class lifestyle, particularly for people from disadvantaged communities, whether it's economically disadvantaged rural communities or whether it's racial and ethnic minorities. They can get places where they wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
David Siegel is a professor of sociology and director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland. Thanks so much for your time.
It was good talking to you, Tess.
So what to do after you've joined the service and seen the world? We're answering questions from military families at marketplace.org. Debt of Service, a Marketplace Money special, continues next from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and we return now to Debt of Service, a special hour on personal finance in the military. A 1994 federal law requires employers to let reservists return to their jobs after being called to active duty. But that promise rings hollow to the ones who run their own businesses. If you're the boss, who can take your place while you're on a 16-month tour? For the National Guardsmen we're about to meet, war meant closing up shop for good. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Colonel Daniel Bordelon faced death while serving in the National Guard. His battlefield wasn't Afghanistan, but New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. The storm turned his 100-acre post into a torrent of flood water 20 feet deep in some places.
Well, we started walking, me and one other guy. By the time we got to right about here, it was already over our heads, and we swam the rest of the way.
Now Bordelon's in charge of rebuilding the same barracks where he almost drowned.
10 o'clock staff meeting.
Roger, sir.
He oversees a budget of $170 million and 80 staffers.
A quick program update. If we could just go around the horn, what's going on in your projects, up, down, sideways. Go ahead, Nick.
It's been more than 4 years, and Bordelon remains on active duty in New Orleans. The extended activation has put an end to his old life as a small business owner.
Before Katrina, I was a chiropractor. Before the mobilization, I was a chiropractor with offices in two different cities, about 30, 40 miles apart.
Bordelon's practice represented two decades of work. The offices had finally started to turn a profit, and he had hundreds of patients. But then came National Guard deployment. When that happens, the Guard is no longer voluntary weekend duty. It's full-time work, and resigning is not an option. When he was mobilized, Bordelon tried to sell his practice, but the offer fell through the day he left for duty. He had no other choice but to liquidate.
I didn't have two or three other chiropractors working for me that could carry the load for me to be gone a year. I was the only guy. So, I mean, as a chiropractor, when your hands leave, you know, your feet leave the building, you stop making money. You stop having a business.
The 46-year-old lost hundreds of thousands of dollars when the deal collapsed. Bordelon's still navigating the financial hardship and his new fixed income from the military. That smaller salary has to stretch pretty far, too. Bordelon's a divorced father and supports sons Jake and Nick and dog Coco.
Come on, Nick.
What you doing?
Most weekdays, he races home from work to pick them all up at his grandmother's house.
So what went on at school today?
After a day of rebuilding the barracks, Bordelon has to worry about rebuilding his own house. It's in Lakeview, a New Orleans neighborhood that was flooded during Katrina. So on the way home, father, sons, and dogs stop at Home Depot for a plumbing connection they've been needing.
We're going to turn our water on tonight. Y'all get to take baths.
Before bath time, though, Bordelon gathers up the boys for pizza at his best friend's house in New Orleans.
He's got the largest title transfer company in Louisiana.
Even though Bordelon lost his chiropractic offices, he still gives adjustments to family and friends. Bordelon's high school buddy, Bob Bergeron, is face down on the coffee table in the living room, a bit stressed.
Bob, we're not wrestling. Let it go.
Got it.
It was Bob Bergeron who talked Bordelon into joining the National Guard after high school. Bergeron says they both needed help for college.
I got in because I couldn't afford the tuition, and the National Guard offered a scholarship to pay for 2 years.
Bergeron got out of the Guard in 2003, just after he'd started his own law firm, Crescent Title Company. The Iraq War was underway. Bergeron knew there was a good chance his unit would be activated. Unlike his best friend, he chose his business over the Guard.
So my option was stay in and risk being activated or get out. And I had started a company with 5 employees, and if I was activated, that was it. My law firm was one lawyer, so if the lawyer's gone, the law firm dismantles. So it was really because of my job.
With a new administration and a new defense secretary, deployment length could shrink. But the change, if it happens, comes too late for Colonel Daniel Bordelon. He thinks about rebuilding his own business someday, but not right now.
Right now, as a battalion commander, I would feel really bad that I'll be bailing on my soldiers when we're facing deployment. Here's the commander leaving, facing deployment. You know, why should I go?
That same sense of duty is probably what led Bordelon to make the choice to stay in the Guard in the first place, no matter the cost to him personally. In New Orleans, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace Money.
Colonel Bordelon shows us where he almost died during Hurricane Katrina and how his crew saved him in a video on our website, marketplace.org.
The U.S. Army Reserve takes a different kind of strength.
The strength to help people one day and lead people the next.
The strength to build confidence one day and build knowledge the next.
The strength to improve your country one day and your career the next.
The strength to be both a citizen and a soldier in the U.S. Army Reserve.
There's strong, and then there's Army strong.
Find out more about the Army Reserve at GoArmyReserve.com.
Americans are rarely forced to think about the financial impact of our current wars. Unlike previous conflicts, we don't have gas or food ration cards. We don't hear pleas to buy war bonds or plant victory gardens. Scholars have been keeping track, though, and recent figures put the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan at about $3 trillion. I asked Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution to break down that price. He says we spend more than $400,000 a year on each soldier in combat.
You're paying for all the infrastructure that supports them, including where they live, the food they eat, the fuel they're consuming when they're on patrol or moving around, not to mention the occasional round of ammunition that's still used even at this point in the conflict, also the activation of reservists to put them on the full-time payroll.
The current wars also rely on private contractors. O'Hanlon says the $400,000 per soldier factors in those salaries.
The ratio in Iraq or Afghanistan of private sector contractors to uniformed troops is about 1-1. This is actually, in the long term, a more economical way to run the military because we don't have to pay those contractors once the war is over. But in the short term, it makes it very expensive because they have to be paid more.
And O'Hanlon says the benefits for soldiers are also expensive. Healthcare for the wounded makes up about a quarter of his calculated cost of war.
If we are having something like, at the height of the conflict anyway, 10,000 people per year wounded, and a typical medical cost might be a couple $100,000, and you're talking about long-term veterans benefits for those who need ongoing care.
I asked O'Hanlon how the $3 trillion cost of war translates into compensation for service members. Is the pay fair?
Yes, people are well enough paid in the military. If the way you think of it is, okay, what could that 19-year-old with the same amount of education likely earn in the private sector? We are paying our troops quite well and somewhat better on average than what most of them would make in the private sector when you include all housing allowances and health care and the like. But then you say, okay, well, obviously, in a time of war, the military is at special risk and accepting that risk on behalf of the country. And they make a little extra money while they're there, but it's only a couple $100 a month. Meanwhile, they've left behind often families and spouses and kids. It's pretty hard to argue that they're being excessively compensated. And so I have to say the short answer to me is no, we're not paying too much.
Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution on the per soldier cost of our current wars.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers.
Military families move about every 3 years. The kids change schools, the house gets sold, or in this market, it doesn't, and the civilian spouse often has to find a job. But a recent study found that military spouses take annual salary cuts of thousands of dollars. At Fort Knox, Kentucky, Marketplace's Amy Scott found some husbands and wives trying to make it work.
It's no wonder military spouses struggle to build careers.
In 18 years, we've been in 14 different houses.
Fort Polk, Fort Carson, Fort Knox, Fort Riley, Fort Knox. And we're getting ready to go back to Riley.
We're on an average of about every 2 years. We did have one assignment that lasted 11 months, so we moved twice in 1 year.
When I visited Fort Knox back in August, Christina Black, the one with the 14 houses, had a job in the Fort Knox Career Center.
We don't have as many clerical type things.
She helped other military spouses find work. but it wasn't exactly her calling.
I have actively been working on a career to become a teacher for the last 12 years. Because we continue to move, I have to keep going back to school, and classes do not transfer well, so I'm still 12 years later, still trying and still have a year left.
In the meantime, Black has trouble moving up in the jobs she does get.
It's just difficult to continue to start at the bottom every time you do get a job. And after 18 years, I'm still starting at the bottom every time we move.
Entry-level work means entry-level pay. A RAND Corporation study a few years ago found that on average, military wives earn $3 less per hour than women married to civilians. They're also more likely to be unemployed. One reason may be that employers are reluctant to hire someone who's just going to turn around and leave in a few years. Lori Burchett had just arrived from Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Even here on post, I've had a couple interviews so far with one of the local military groups here. The first question out of their mouth was, how long are you going to live here? I could just see the skepticism on their faces. And these are military people. It's hard.
So hard that some women just don't bother. Karen Ware's husband is in the Navy. She worked for a while as a chiropractic assistant in Bremerton, Washington, and loved it. But she gave up on the idea of a career long ago.
Being separated is such a strain on a marriage and everything. I chose to follow him. I could have stayed and gone back to school and started a career path, but I would have missed out on so much. And I just felt that, you know, for me, my place was with my husband.
Don't snap it quite so hard, see what it does.
Women aren't the only ones who make that choice. At the Fort Knox PX, Jim Lever treats his son TJ to a double hamburger and Coke.
Good, healthy, nutritious meal prepared by his stay-at-home dad.
With his cropped hair and athletic build, Lever looks like a soldier out of uniform. But he hung up the green suit about 15 years ago. Since then, Lever has followed his wife from post to post as she's built her career in the Army. He keeps busy doing volunteer work. He teaches a weekly spin class at the gym. And at 3 o'clock, when the kids come home from school, he's there to meet them.
I could have gone to another job and made a lot of money, and then we'd have paid about half that money for a nanny or for child care, and then who would be raising my kids?
For military spouses who do want careers outside the home, the Defense Department is trying to help. A new law in the works aims to open up more government jobs. A $35 million initiative provides job training and money for tuition in some states. The goal is to steer military spouses towards portable jobs in industries like healthcare, information technology, and construction. With two wars underway, retaining servicemen and women is more crucial than ever. Until recently, Kathy Lambert ran Fort Knox's Employment Readiness Program.
The Army has realized that, you know, it does affect retention. Since most of our families now are two-income families, that employment is a major issue in soldiers making a decision whether or not to stay in the military. You know, spouse has to be happy too.
Recently, I called Christina Black, one of the women I met at Fort Knox, to find out how she was doing.
We're sorry. You have reached a number that has been disconnected or is no longer in service.
She and her family had moved again. In Fort Knox, Kentucky, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
There's a hungry kind of feeling, oh! And every day it grows. You know there's so much more to you than anybody knows.
In the Army, we do more before 9 a.m. than most people do all day.
Service members in Iraq and Afghanistan are surviving injuries that would have killed them in previous wars. Medical and technical advances save soldiers whose bodies are burned, skulls punctured, or limbs severed. But many wounded soldiers will need constant care the rest of their lives. Friends and family often put aside their own careers and retirement plans to look after them. Legislation introduced in the House this year might give financial support to these caregivers. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler considers the impact of a war injury on an entire family's bottom line.
3 years ago, Nellie Bagley was working full-time as a quality control supervisor in New Hampshire. Then, in March 2006, she got the news about her son, Jose Pequeño, a military policeman, had been ambushed and seriously wounded in Iraq.
That was the end of my work. I mean, they held my job for 6 months because we thought it was going to be a short stay.
It wasn't. Jose suffered a traumatic brain injury. He underwent 17 surgeries, moving from hospital to hospital. Every step of the way, Nellie was there. Told that contact with family members is the best medicine, she spent night and day at his bedside.
What choice do you have? Put him in a nursing home? I would never do that to my son. Never. As long as I have my breath, I will take care of my son.
The military pays for Jose's medical care, but there's no financial support for Nellie.
We need to understand that when a soldier is wounded, the entire family is affected. It's not just that individual soldier.
That's Paul Rykoff, executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He says many parents and spouses have to give up their jobs to care for a wounded veteran full time.
Especially with the traumatic brain injuries where folks can't feed themselves, can't wash themselves, can't support themselves. And it's the mother or the father or sometimes even the grandparents who are single-handedly responsible for keeping that person alive and taking care of them.
When I visited last September, Jose was at the VA Poly Trauma Center in Tampa. Lying in bed in the ICU, Jose was connected to a heart monitor and a feeding tube. He had some movement in his right hand, but that's it. He made sounds, but not words.
He doesn't speak, but he communicates very well with us.
Jose's sister, Elizabeth, would visit at least once a day.
How are you doing?
Are you behaving?
Taking care of Jose has taken over their lives. Elizabeth had been pursuing a business degree at college.
That went out the window. Got rid of my apartment. I ended up selling off my car. And what we did get as financial support from the military while he was active duty went towards the bills. Once that stopped, then my mother and I were put in a predicament of, okay, how are we going to pay the bills now?
Jose's disability benefits go to support his two kids who don't live with him. There's no financial support for the extended family. Nellie's had to drain her savings.
We went through their retirement. When you take it out early, you got a penalty, so we lose that.
She also lost her health insurance when she left her job. Now she bears the financial burden of her diabetes. To cut costs, Nellie and Elizabeth ate soup or macaroni and cheese.
We ended up going a couple days without food just because we needed the money.
Fortunately, Nellie had a free room at Fisher House, a charity that provides temporary housing for the families of wounded vets. 24-year-old Elizabeth got a job in the hospital cafeteria.
I'm supporting my mother, myself, and of course we both have bills. There's no extra little frivolities that normal people would be able to do because every penny is needed to support the family while we take care of my brother.
Jose is now out of the hospital. Nellie rented a house for them near Tampa. But that's not the end of the journey.
I don't think people really understand that is this not an injury that is a 3 weeks or 6 weeks or 2 months. These are guys that are not going to be able to take care of themselves for the rest of their life.
The local American Legion has lent a hand. It started a campaign selling barbecue sauce to raise money for Jose to buy the house they now rent. With or without the financial assistance, Nellie plans to stay with her son. In Tampa, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
Coming up, more from our special Debt of Service. We've been taking personal finance questions from military members and their families for weeks. You can see answers from our economics editor, Chris Farrell, online at marketplace.org. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Back to debt of service, a special hour exploring issues of personal finance in the military. Anthony Swofford served in the first Gulf War as an elite sniper in the Marines. His best-selling memoir, Jarhead, shares that story. When Swofford came back from months of active duty, where he marched through burning oil fields and sifted through bombed Iraqi corpses, he prepared to enter civilian life and faced a grim economic reality.
As a corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps, I made less than $800 a month after taxes. My car payment was around $180 a month. I drove a modest Nissan 4x4 pickup. The rest of the money I spent on car insurance, food, that mainstay of the Marine diet, beer, and the gas I needed to escape from the desert Marine base of 29 Palms to Los Angeles on the weekends. We'd been back from the Gulf War for a year, but combat still haunted us, and we were always ready to fight the next battle. It should come as no surprise that many of us looked over our finances with aggressive irresponsibility, if not outright malevolence. If you might die very soon, why on earth should you care about your bank balance? They can't squeeze car payments from a dead Marine, can they? Then borrow the money for the car at a criminally high APR from one of those jalopy dealers outside the base. Say yes to that credit card, and say yes to that one as well. I'd always planned to leave the Marine Corps after 4 years to attend college. I was in that fourth year, and I'd saved exactly $0 beyond the $14,000 in my GI Bill. I'd live with the fantasy that the GI Bill would see me through an undergrad degree and onto graduate school, and that I'd not have to work. When I started looking seriously at colleges, I realized that the government money wouldn't pay for more than a few semesters of tuition and rent. Beatnik fantasies cost more than I'd ever realized. I began to panic. A Marine I knew, who had three kids and an unemployed wife, had been delivering for a Pizza Hut out in town. The moonlighting Marine was a common enough sight. They worked as bartenders, taxi drivers, and motel clerks, but most of those guys were married with kids. One afternoon, I headed out to the Pizza Hut. The manager looked like a cousin to the Mario Brothers. He hired me on the spot and gave me a uniform and told me to report the next day, a Friday, at 4. Depressingly, the Pizza Hut uniform shared a color scheme with the vaunted Marine Corps dress blues. The polyester pants were blue, and the shirt was blue and red with blue piping. After a 5K run in the morning and an afternoon on the rifle range, I shed my battle dress camouflage uniform. I made the horrible mistake of donning the Pizza Hut threads while still in the barracks. At the time, I was a co-leader of my platoon, and as my men changed into shorts, t-shirts, and flip-flops and prepared to party like it was 1999, I walked a reverse walk of shame from the barracks to the parking lot. My subordinates howled in delight as they watched their fearless leader scamper off to deliver pizzas. I could find my way on foot with a map and compass through any landscape on Earth, but in my truck was rather lost in the sprawling exurbs of the high desert. I bungled more than a few deliveries and received multiple cold pizza complaints. I delivered to a number of military families, and I recall these people averting their gaze when something in my bearing or my haircut tipped them off that I was a Marine. As I recall, I made about $40 that night. When I got back to the barracks after midnight, my men were sufficiently drunk and passed out that I was able to slip into my room unnoticed. I looked at myself in the mirror, hair askew, a little puffy at the eyes. The pizza-stained uniform made my combatant's body look like a sack of bloated dough. I did the simple math. In 8 months, I'd be out of the Corps, and my moonlighting would have netted me a few thousand dollars at most. I never went back. Better to be a very broke college student than a member of the world's most elite fighting force, schlepping deep dish on a Friday night.
Jarhead author Anthony Swofford's latest book is the novel Exit A.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Oh, yeah!
Oh, yeah!
Here we go!
Here we go!
I used to sit at home all day.
I used to sit at home all day.
Oh, letting my life
life a waste away.
Letting my life a waste away.
Oh, and then one day a man in blue. Oh,
and one day a man in blue.
Said, son, I got a job for you.
Said, son, I got a job for you.
There's a trouble adventure.
Since 9/11, a lot more charities have sprung up that claim to help veterans. Americans give more than $1 million a day to these groups. But some give as little as one penny per dollar donated to service members. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has our story.
Sitting in her cozy home in Reading, Pennsylvania, Yvonne Oppenheimer rifles through a large cardboard box stuffed with solicitations from various veterans charities.
And I would say there's probably 20, 30 letters. And this is just in the last month.
The letters are addressed to her brother, Gerard Fry. He died more than a year ago. His mail is forwarded to Oppenheimer. She says her brother donated to veterans charities for decades.
They knew they had him.
Oppenheimer says her brother was a veteran.
He was the kind of person that anything that came in with an American flag, the word veteran, that was it. He wrote out a check.
Lots of other people write checks to veterans charities, too. Patrick Rooney is with the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University.
Almost everybody, regardless of ideology and politics, feel sorry for a veteran who comes back wounded. And so it's an easy case to make for philanthropic support.
Easy and profitable. Charities have to register in some states, and states' attorneys general investigate scams. But no law says charities have to give away a certain percentage of their money. They do have to fill out an IRS form stating how much cash they raised and how much they spent on charitable activities. But they don't have to disclose that in their fundraising appeals. As chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, Congressman Henry Waxman held hearings on veterans' charities. The California Democrat left the committee, but his successor will continue his investigation. Waxman says sometimes donations wind up in the pockets of a charity's executives.
People need to be aware that there are organizations that are out to get their money and not really do what they claim to do.
The most efficient veterans charities devote 2/3 of contributions to vets, but some give away just a quarter of their donations. Roger Chapin runs several veterans charities. He didn't respond to requests for an interview, but he did testify at one of Waxman's hearings. Chapin's charities raised more than $168 million from 2004 to 2006. Chapin was asked why, in some cases, only 25 cents of every dollar his charities collect goes to veterans. He said it takes money to raise money, and he said he'd be out of business if his fundraising appeals had to spell out how little goes to veterans.
If we disclose, which I'm more than happy to do, we'll all be out of business. Nobody would donate. It would dry up.
Chapin didn't elicit much sympathy, but other charities say disclosure of raw numbers can be misleading. They can have legitimate reasons for not giving away most of their money in a given year. Kathleen Burke is director of development for the National Military Family Association.
You have to invest in infrastructure, management, and other things. You can't always be spending everything all the time on programs necessarily. It would be detrimental over the long term.
Burke says some charities save up money for years, say for a college scholarship for a one-year-old whose father was killed while serving in Iraq. Congress is struggling with how to protect donors without hurting legitimate charities. Lawmakers say the short-term answer is for donors to do some research. Independent charity watchdogs provide information on overhead expenses. Some have links to the charity's IRS forms on their websites. Back in Reading, Yvonne Oppenheimer says her brother never investigated the charities he contributed to. Some people don't have the energy or time to check out a charity. Oppenheimer's brother was still giving money away even as he was dying. Oppenheimer says at the very least, the federal government should funnel more money to state's attorneys general, who are the frontline investigators of charities.
We have to have watchdogs. The public can't do it all.
Oppenheimer says a government watchdog could have helped prevent her brother from giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to unvetted charities. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Nancy's cautionary note notwithstanding, there are plenty of military-related charities that do put the bulk of their donations directly towards soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. Patrick Sowers runs one of them.
When you donate here, you know you're donating to someone who works every day,
that's willing to defend and give his life for his country. It's not about Iraq or about Afghanistan. Helping soldiers is about helping soldiers. Helping soldiers isn't about war.
Sowers is the founder and president of a Dallas-based nonprofit called Operation Once in a Lifetime. Last year, the charity took in $50,000 in donations and helped, by his estimation, 5,000 soldiers. I met up with him in Plano, Texas, where about a year ago, he opened a resale store.
There's a resale centers for everything. So I was like, there should be a resale center that benefits soldiers. I mean, dogs and cats can have one. A soldier should have one as well.
The public can come into the store and buy things. Soldiers can walk out with anything they want for free. Sowers is 32. He joined the Army in 1998 and spent 4 years on active duty and another 4 in the reserves. Now he manages the maintenance department at a local car dealership. The resale store is just one element of what's become a far-reaching effort to provide soldiers with, well, whatever they need. We hopped in his truck for a drive from Plano, south to Fort Hood in Killeen. Sowers makes the trek several times a month.
So what do we have in the truck today? What are we taking down to Fort Hood?
I'd say about $3,000 in linen.
Linens?
Linens, right. What happens is when you go to Iraq and Afghanistan, if you're a single soldier, you put everything in storage. Well, typically you don't have access for that for 2 to 3 weeks.
So he's delivering a little slice of home for the barracks. He's also garnered tickets to the Dallas Mavericks for wounded soldiers. And he finds people with extra airline miles and uses them to fly soldiers home during holidays.
And one reason why I started this was went from making $30,000 a year as an E-5 sergeant to, you know, start working in the auto industry and work for Lexus. Back in my mind, it's, you know, I didn't think it was really fair that I'll work 3 times harder and put more on the line being in the military, but now I'll work half as hard and make 3 times more money. It's better.
Several times during the 3-hour trip, his phone rang with someone requesting help, a military wife whose car broke down on her way to visit her wounded husband, an Army recruiter in Cleveland checking up on Cavaliers tickets for recruits in Ohio. The team donated a $6,000 suite.
No soldier would ever be able to afford to do something like that, ever, you know.
Yes, sir. Still got more coming.
We arrived at Fort Hood early afternoon.
Truly fantastic, Patrick. Thank you very much.
Several soldiers came out to unpack all those sheets and pillows from the truck. Sergeant Major Miguel Carrion said the delivery would give newly arrived soldiers a place to call home.
Of the things we have received from the support through Operation Once a Lifetime, just today we prepared 150 rooms. And in the next 2 days we'll do another 300 rooms.
So if you didn't have this, what would soldiers literally coming off the plane from Iraq?
Literally to a naked room and a naked bed.
And while we were talking, off in a corner, Sowers was helping fulfill another need for Private Daniel Holmes, just back from a 15-month tour in Iraq.
So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give you a check for $700. So
thank you very much.
No problem. I'll take a quick picture of this.
The money went toward a U-Haul and plane tickets to get Holmes home to Arizona. Before we parted ways, I asked Sergeant Sowers whether all this should be something the military takes care of on its own.
It doesn't make me feel bad that the military's not doing more. I think the military's geared to try and help in as much as possible. But with all these unique situations, that they're just not going to be able to do all of it.
On our way from Dallas to Fort Hood, we stopped at a local Hooters. The restaurant had donated wings, fries, and drinks for about 2 dozen wounded soldiers. Patrick ended up buying lunch for 56 more service members scattered throughout the restaurant. And after the meal, he handed out $5,000 worth of tickets to Dallas Stars hockey games, courtesy of team captain Brendan Morrow. One of the recipients was a young woman in a plain white T-shirt and jeans. She sat down next to me, and I noticed a long scar running down her left forearm. Her name is Angel Herrera, and she's an Army sergeant, 30 years old. She drove trucks for an engineering unit in Afghanistan until an incident last September ended her tour of duty.
We were woken up in the middle of the night, the night before we were supposed to leave, and the night person that was on watch came in, woke everybody up, and said that we had confirmed incoming and to grab gear and get in the bunkers. The mortars started hitting, and when I stepped through, I looked up, and I saw it looked like a gigantic football on fire coming at me. And was confirmed later as a RPG, which is a rocket-propelled grenade. It hit me in the abdomen, and I took shrapnel to my left forearm and to my neck, where it severed my jugular. I have numerous internal injuries, to include my liver, my spleen, my stomach, my intestines, my lungs, and I still have shrapnel left inside also.
You've made the decision that you want to stay in the Army if they'll let you. Why?
The fact that I got hurt, for me, I could walk across the street and get hit by a bus. I just happened to catch the RPG. Most people don't understand about the military. It's another job, just like any other job, except for you have the bonus of a deployment. A lot of people don't like it. I do. I enjoy doing my job. I think it's an honor and a privilege to be in the military, and hopefully they'll allow me to stay.
You came into the military fairly late, at age 26?
Yes.
What did you do before that? What was your career path?
I was a cook for about 8 years.
Given what has happened to you, what's attractive about staying with the Army versus returning to civilian life?
It's a steady paycheck. You never have to worry about not getting paid. When you're not deployed, you have every holiday off imaginable. I get to spend it with my family. I've had Christmases with my kids that in previous years I didn't get to have because I had to go to work, especially in the profession that I was in as a cook. I was paying almost $800 a month for insurance just for my children. In the military, I can take them to the doctor anytime they need it. The military pays the whole thing. The other thing is, with the economy the way it is right now, most people are losing their jobs. I'm not going to lose my job.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you.
That was Army Sergeant Angel Herrera at an event for wounded soldiers just outside Fort Hood, Texas, last month. And we've given her the final word in this week's Marketplace Money special on personal finance in the military. Be sure to visit our website, marketplace.org, for all kinds of extras and photos to go with today's stories, as well as links to other sites that provide financial help to service members around the world. And to address the news of the week, we also have a web-only interview with details of President Barack Obama's new housing rescue plan. Debt of Service was produced by Eve Troe and directed by Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.